Kia ora and welcome to this episode of Better Off Read, in which I, Pip Adam, talk to Tim Corbulis about his new book, RHI, which is a book of two novellas. The R of the title stands for Joan Riviere, who was an early English psychoanalyst. I feel very nervous saying that it stands for her. There is a Joan R at the beginning in the first novella, and I feel really resistant to saying that she's the subject of the first novella, but she is there and seems somewhat as a symbol or a guide through that novella. The H of the title, there is a character called H in the second novella who has an interesting relationship to Hermann Henselmann, who was a German architect and is most famous for quite a few post-war buildings that were built for the German Democratic Republic. And the I of the title, I think I heard Tim saying this at an interview, but the I for me stands sort of for the author himself and sort of stands for Tim, because there's huge honesty in this book about how the history and it sort of shows its workings of how history is sort of filtered through an author's mind and an author's writing. So yeah, that's RHI. Before you start listening, I need to let you know that I made a very stupid mistake. While I was conducting this interview, I asked Tim to define communism and then proceeded to talk over his explanation of that. Tim quotes the quite famous phrase, from each according to their ability, to each according to their need. It's wonderful. Actually, it's wonderful and nice to say that in this introduction. And it was wonderful to hear Tim say it as well. And I'm sorry that I spoke over the top of him. Oh, don't do that, kids. We also talk about a video in this interview. And you can see this video or a link to it on betterreadnz.wordpress.com. That's where we have all our show notes as well. So if you want to go and read up about anything, that's where they are. So yeah, this podcast begins with Fergus Barrowman, the publisher of this book from Victoria University Press, putting the book into context at the celebration for this book, which was held at 19 Torrey Street, which is a wonderful venue in Wellington run by the Concerned Citizens Collective. Fergus puts this book beautifully in context with Tim's other work and also with, you know, where it sits as a book in New Zealand today. So yeah, I hope you enjoy it. Thank you.
Thank you to the team here for having us here. Thank you all for coming, and thanks, Tim, for another book. This is the fourth book of fiction by Tim that he has published. The first was Below, a lovely little novel that won a prize, for the best source of the prize. And one of the interesting things about Tim is that each book, as it's gone on, has become a little stranger. Tim has gone away and sort of spent some time working on a PhD in aesthetics, but he's sort of hauled himself back up to the high ground here with another book of fiction. But it's quite an unusual book, and I think you'll find it an incredibly interesting and rewarding reading experience. There was a session at Writers on Monday, Te Papa, a couple of days ago, and there's a bit of talk there about pulling the rug out from under the reader's feet. Well, this is a book which doesn't actually have a rug to start. what it has is a welcome mat with a really nice little personal introduction, which is fully part of the book. It's not sort of outside of the book, and it sort of frames and encompasses the two fictions which follow. And that's what makes this such an interesting and such a sort of considered work. So you're on that welcome mat, everything makes sense, and then suddenly the ground drops out from under your feet. It's a terrific one.
Okay, so here we are. Kia ora, Tim.
Kia ora.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
I'm with Tim Corbulis and we're at Victoria University in a room. It's very beige room, lemon, I think. And we are here to talk about your fantastic new book, which is called RHI, Two
Indeed.
Novellas.
Thank you, yep.
It's magnificent.
Oh,
Thank you.
Yes, I loved it so much. I got very, very excited about it.
Cool. Thanks, Pip. It's always good to start with praise.
Yeah, that would be awful, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I hate it. No, I really enjoyed it. And I guess I wanted to start around, like you've talked about this and people keep asking about it, but I'm interested in the event of these kind of being collected under two covers, if you know what I mean, rather than being two separate novellas.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's got a bit of a history. So when I went to Berlin, under the Creative New Zealand Berlin Writer in Residence program, the project that I was supposed to do there and didn't do, for whatever reason, was supposed to be three novellas in one volume.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was always in the back of my mind to have, I guess not a book of short stories, but a book of longer, you know, longer things. And they were going to be kind of three things, all from sort of, I mean, not linked in terms of their subject matter, the way these ones are also not linked in terms of the subject matter, but they were all going to be sort of thematically balanced. And it was a really ambitious project and far too ambitious for me to actually do. So that was always in the background. I wrote most of, or a lot of, the first one there, and the other two kind of fell apart. They didn't actually make much sense, as it turned out. And when I came back to R a couple of years later, I sent it to VEP, and they were willing to publish it on its own, which is fantastic. But they also said, you know, and I can't remember who, you know, who raised the issue of another one or whatever, but they said it would be better. And I agreed with that. So I'd had this idea to write about Herman Hanselmann as well while I was in Berlin. And I had some material towards that as well. So that just seemed like a kind of a natural thing to do, partly in terms of the size of a book. Like novellas are a hard size. I think they're a lovely size of book, but they're a hard, kind of a hard size to sell. Which is not something I was thinking about hugely, but, you know, that was in the back of their mind with, you know, fair enough. And but also I just really like the idea of putting the two together and having them reflect off each other, and almost accidentally, you know, how it's, I wasn't, you know, how I've talked about the book in the author's note as being about, you know, it's like it has a historical arc to it, to the whole thing, you know, across the two different novellas. That kind of happened a bit by accident. I wasn't really thinking in those terms when I wrote it. It was just two things. One happened to be around World War I, the other one happened to be around World War II. So that just ended up working quite well. Mm. Yeah.
Because that's what I think so great about it, is the very act of putting the two together seems to energize. That's a very Los Angeles term. But, you know, like that, it seems to sort of put some, you know, motion and movement around. It kind of reminded me of that Dada thing of sort of, if you put two things together, they kind of give it, electrify each other in a way.
Yeah.
And especially around, I mean, you've talked about this, but especially around that idea of masks, you know, where in R we have a character who, you know, conceives of herself as a mask, and then in H we have this great, oh my God, I loved reading you writing about buildings. I think this has made my decade. But, you know, like that idea that a building is kind of a mask as well. You know, like its interior is also empty in a way.
Yeah. That's interesting. That stuff just kind of emerged as well. But I mean, you know, going back to the Dada or surrealist idea of juxtaposition, I had that in the back of my mind a lot. And it doesn't just happen at the level of the two books next to each other. There's a lot of it within each book as well, because they're quite fragmentary in their structure, and there's a lot of effects. I mean, in a way, they're kind of potentially slightly lazy effects. You know, Eisenstein, who used to the kind of the first theorist of montage in film. You know, he talked about left montage, the idea that you can get an effect just by putting anything, any two things together, you know, and he was slightly scathing of it, I think. And it's not quite what I've done, but there are points in the book where I've thrown some stuff in a little bit at random. And maybe there is something there about masks, you know, about masks being surfaces. You know, there's a lot in this book that I don't want people necessarily, because it's a little bit of an unusual book in some ways, you know. And if people come to it and think it's unusual, the temptation might be, well, what's the secret under the surface of this book? I don't really want people to be doing that. I'm happy for people to be looking at the slightly strange surfaces and them to still be slightly strange surfaces, you know, without having to find this hidden secret. And I think one of the effects of putting two different kinds of things close together is can be a surface effect. It can be a really lovely effect of what happens when you suddenly throw something quite unexpected into the, you know, unexpected to the writer as well as to the reader, I guess, eh?
I was just reading, Anna Sanderson has let me read some of her PhD.
Oh, you're lucky thing.
I know, I'm the luckiest person in the world. This has been the greatest month of my life. And there's an interesting statement in there from a theorist called McCloskey about efferent reading versus aesthetic reading. If you're reading, I think this is right, I'll probably get it wrong, but if you're reading for an efferent purpose, you're thinking about what you'll take away from the book.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're reading aesthetically, you're kind of in that experience as you're reading.
Yes.
And I was thinking that was something I really enjoyed about this, is that, you know, it seems, you know, to begin with, I was kind of like, okay, I'm learning about history at the moment. But then eventually that just fell away to this absolutely amazing experience of reading.
Right.
And the fragmented nature of it, not quite knowing what would come next. And I know, particularly with R, just really enjoying that constant kind of psychoanalysis of the self, you know, like here we finally get to have characters who are thinking about their motives and stuff, which I just loved it. But because your PhD deals with aesthetics, people keep bandying that around
you. I know, it's weird. I sort of wish I'd never kind of it's nice that people mention it, because it is influential to me. You know, I spent a lot of years thinking about this stuff, but it's not, I don't know if it lent me a whole lot of terms to come away and talk about. I mean, probably the terms that are just sort of obvious with RHI, you know, montage, juxtaposition, all those kinds of things. I mean, they're things I thought about a bit in my PhD, and I don't think I thought about them in any profound original senses, but they're surprisingly powerful, you know, just the idea of putting two things side by side is... It's so obvious about, because it's what all creative work of any sort does at some basic level, is just assemble, really. You know, that's what goes on. So there's something very basic about it. But thinking through the levels at which you can do that, you know, the putting whole stories next to each other, putting fragments, putting, I mean, even at some level, putting words next to each other, which is obviously what we do, but you know, if you think at the level of what word am I going to put next to whatever other word, you can also, as opposed to writing in a sort of more fluent way, you can get interesting effects there. I mean, not to say that that's what I've really done in RHI, but
that keeps coming to me is the effect in H of putting I wrote, you know, there was that little fragment that was dropped in.
Yeah.
It's I wrote, isn't it? I was just thinking of the effect of that interruption. Do you know what I mean? The story, I wrote. Yes. There's something really magnificent about that.
Oh, cool. That's a little bit stolen, that, actually. influenced, I should say. Influenced. There was an influence. Thomas Bernhard, actually. I used to read a lot of Thomas Bernhard, someone that Damon Wilkins put me onto a million years ago. And he does that quite a lot in his writing. And I love it. I really like it. And I guess it's a framing device, you know, to be framing the story in a kind of the story of the author who wrote the story or something like that. But I actually see it more the way you described it as also an interruption, almost a purely formal thing that it just comes as a bit of punctuation. And I'm really interested in this book in interruptions, and as I came to the end of it, and as I sort of finished the novellas off, and I wrote the author's note and was thinking about the book, interruption was something I thought about more and more at that time, actually. and I, in a lot of different ways, and it's partly that as I was doing it, I was, you know, I was partly, you know, part-time looking after young kids, which is all about interruption, you know, that's kind of the way family life works around a whole lot of interruptions. I was studying at the same time, so just juggling a whole lot of stuff. And I came to kind of think, well, and I have talked about this before as well, but the idea that the book emerges from the conditions of its writing, partly, that it's full of interruptions to itself, and kind of thinking that actually I quite like that, you know, I quite like, and I quite like the idea that the reader might be interrupted as well, that actually the book might be, this, the fragmentary nature of the book might also make the reader not read it all the way through in one sitting, and that might actually interrupt people and make them look up from the book sometimes. This is something that's become quite important to me, the idea of writing work that people might stop reading, and not for forever, hopefully, but that the reading experience might be a very present experience, that it might make you actually quite present in the world, rather than taking you away into another world that the book builds for you, and that somehow that's a hope for this book anyway. I don't know if I'm enough of a kind of a psychologist to know about what effect it'll actually have on readers, right? But the idea that all the little interruptions that happen in the book are bits of history, sometimes they're bits of history that I've just been writing, and I kind of think, oh, I might just look some stuff up on the internet, you know. I'm sitting here at my computer, why not just look at a different window, find some stuff I'm writing about 19, whatever, look what happened in that year, throw it into the book. And it's like history throws these little bombs into the book. Instead of trying to evoke the world of that year, make that year something that's actually almost impossible to evoke, just because there's all this stuff, it just happens, you know, and it drops in. And that kind of idea, it just became more and more important to me. I can't quite work out exactly why, except maybe there's this idea that a slight discomfort around the way fiction takes us away from the world, and wanting my readers to keep living in the world while they read, or something like that. Not that fiction takes you away too far, but yeah, that it will make you look up and live in the world, even in the act of reading.
Because that was one of the things I really enjoyed about it. And I think temperamentally, I feel like, you know, I often come across books and I think, oh, this was written for me. But like, I do love, and I never have been able to explain it, but you've explained it really, really well. I love reading things where I'm never allowed to forget that I'm reading. You know, I don't know why. I just really love.
Yeah.
And that's what I particularly liked about this is that fragmented nature, and just having to always, it was a very active relationship with the book for me, because I was constantly having to, you know, remember the I is a version of you, the H is a version of that person, you know, the R is a version.
Yes.
And one of the questions I did want to ask you, which seems really basic and silly, is why did you not just invent an architect? You know, I mean, I think you've already answered it to a certain extent, but why not just invent a stand-in? You know, a stand-in woman who's interested in the psycho, Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it is part of the same thing. It's part about wanting to see the book as a kind of way of registering history rather than evoking it. And in a way, you know, why didn't I invent an architect in East Berlin? It's a way of kind of saying East Berlin had an effect on me. Do you know what I mean? And it's a real thing. And it's not also a character. You know what I mean? The real person, Herman Henselmann, built these buildings, and I want to register what they kind of are for me, but also by saying that it's not exactly him, is to say that registering of what they are for me isn't that I know about him. Or something like that.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of a kind of modesty in that.
Yeah.
You know, that this is just kind of what I think.
Yeah.
You know, and what kind of happened to me. I mean, nothing happened, you know, in any profound sense, but, you know, what those buildings. And the same with reading Revere. I think that was a much more sketchy kind of thing where I kind of came across her and became interested. And I started that a long time ago. You know, I started that more than 10 years ago, the Revere stuff. And I think it's hard for me to remember what effect it had on me. So maybe the relationship with her is slightly different, but again, it's this kind of wanting to see history as something which leaves traces in the book, as opposed to the book trying to invent a history. Not that you read it, you know, you still read it as if they're characters. There's plenty of dialogue and you know, action and stuff in there, but alongside that, or at least sort of interrupting that, there's this idea, this kind of constant refrain that they're not, as you say, that, you know, you kind of have to keep remembering that this isn't quite history or something, eh?
And there does seem something a lot more, now I'm gonna get myself in trouble. But there does seem something more appealing to me about that, simply because it doesn't feel like kind of grabbing someone else's experience and saying, I know this experience inside out and I know what it is. You know, it doesn't feel like that horrible, you know, like, I'm just thinking, you know, there have been books which I've read about famous people, and I always feel very frustrated in fiction that I'm thinking, well, what's true and what's not true? And, you know, like, I know what I'm like as a fiction writer. I want everything to fit neatly.
Yes.
And life doesn't fit neatly. And I was thinking that's what I really enjoyed, particularly about H, is the fact that it's constantly being undone by what I'm reading is truth. You know, well, what I'm reading is events that happen, you know, like the wanting to go and not going and going and going and coming back and going. You know, like, I think that's a wonderful thing to bring to a work like this. Do you... what was I going to say? The other day we were at the prison, and William... I've said this a million times because it blew my mind. One of the women asked, what's the difference between fact and fiction?
Yeah.
Fiction and non-fiction. And William Brandt said, non-fiction is where it's true. Fiction is where it doesn't matter if it's true or
not. That's interesting.
And I think that was... That kind of hit me in a way that I hadn't thought before.
Yeah.
And when I was reading this, I was thinking, oddly...
Yes.
Because this isn't evoking,
I
suddenly am identifying some things that I'm reading as actual events and some things that I'm reading as possibly not actual events.
Yeah.
But you're quite clear. Is it important to you that those are separated in the book? Or
I never thought about
that
before, actually. I mean, that's a really nice way of framing it, because it makes fiction into a perspective on the world rather than anything else. And I think, for me, I don't think it does matter whether any of it's true. Not in a big history kind of sense. Because I'm sure there's plenty in there that isn't. I mean, quite apart from the made-up stuff about what so-and-so was thinking or saying to someone, there's plenty of... Like, there's stuff that I just grabbed off the internet. You know, that's almost certainly not true, right?
I'm very disappointed.
But it comes from somewhere.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? It's true to the degree that it exists out there as some language and some thought, and maybe that's kind of as good as we get or something, and that's the kind of truth that's useful, because it's the kind that floats around and is used by people to argue and to justify and to talk, and, you know, it's living. You know, what, it's very hard to, you can't go back to the past, time travel aside, and see it. So it's the kind of the bits and pieces that are left over from the past. That's what's interesting to me. And I guess, you know, RHI, one way of looking at the book is as a kind of a big pile of stuff left over from the past and filtered heavily through me, you know, or variously heavily. Some of it's taken verbatim. You know, some of it is pages from Freud's and Jones's letters to each other, or things like that. I mean, there's a whole kind of move to be writing in this way that I'm not actually all that familiar with, but I'm kind of more becoming more and more aware of, you know, Kenneth Goldsmith and all that kind of thing, which I don't know if I'd want to push it as far as he does, but it's also very much a contemporary art kind of idea that you follow interests as a writer or an artist, and you collect scraps, and then you know, contemporary artists do this all the time. They go and find stuff and they shove it in a gallery and say, hey, look what I found. And it's basically what contemporary art does. Check this out. You know, I'll shove it in a gallery for you. It's a bit of the world that I found lying around, you know.
Even like today with the Parkin Prize, you know, the etchings off the woman's floor.
Which are just so...
fucking beautiful, yeah, you know, like this, yeah. And I just, this is what I think so interesting when we look at the, you know, this huge thing of World War One, World War Two, you know, like, it feels like our view of it becomes more complicated as we leave, which really excites me, because I feel like, and I feel this thing you're talking about how it exists in, out there, you know, that, my understanding is that that's how memory inside a human works, is that we actually retell ourselves the story over and over again. And it feels like as a group of people, we do that as well.
Yeah.
And that's what I really enjoy as well, is these... Because I was thinking a little bit of Lynn Jenner's book as well. I would love to get you two in a room, actually. But, you know, it kind of complicates this big behemoth, which is World War One and World War Two.
Yes.
One of the things I'm quite interested in, I don't even know how this can be answered, is what is it for... And you talk about Antipodean in the VUP interview, but what is it for a New Zealander to come and write that? Like, I mean, that just sounds so nationalistic, but I just mean, what is it to come to these, you know, from here and from, you know, decades away?
It's funny because abstracting that from the kind of question of nationalism or question of whether it's okay, because of course it's okay.
Well, you did it.
But well, I hope it's okay. But I, you know, I guess my idea of what it's for is just that coming from somewhere else gives you a wonderful excuse to be a bit of an ignorant doofus to kind of plonk around and gather stuff up. There's this trope in Australian cultural studies, I think. This is something I stumbled across in my thesis, you know, I probably wouldn't have read this stuff otherwise, but about Australia having been prematurely postmodern, that it was already postmodern, you know. And it's one of these slightly crap things, because it's a version of what Australia is that I think it ignores indigeneity to large a degree, but... It's also interesting in that it sees Australia as a place where a whole lot of cultural forms come to the place, removed from their contexts, and then Australian people take them and say, thanks very much, we'll just throw all this into the mix.
Yeah.
You know, it's just forms removed from contexts. And I think there's some... sort of truth to that. Whether there's any kind of profound moral truth to it, I doubt, but I think there's some kind of truth to that being what can happen. You know, that you can... There's less weight. There's nervousness. Like, writing about Hanselman, I was nervous. And writing about Revere, I was nervous in terms of their relatives and descendants. You know, that kind of nerves that, oh, I'm getting them wrong. But there's also a wonderful freedom to get them wrong. And I guess that's partly... The getting them wrong's quite explicit in the desire not to call them by their full names, just by to call them, you know, by their desire to call them their initial letters. I don't know... I guess I don't know what that translates to in terms of an Antipodean... view of the Antipodes. I suspect you can't then have the same
mm.
approach. But in terms of our relationship to somewhere like Europe and that history, which has been so influential in the whole world, you know, not that they were actually world wars, but they were big wars,
yeah.
and, you know, big shaping things. I think that's quite handy.
Yeah.
You know, this, that ability to say, look, we are in this situation that's not very special. It's far flung. We're kind of sitting here halfway around the world and we can still make something of this.
Mm.
You know, we can still have thoughts about it. We can build ways of thinking out of what's falling to us here. And that's quite nice.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. Now I'm going to go stupid again. When I think about these two books, I think about psychoanalysis and communism.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's largely because these are the people that are involved.
Yeah.
I'm so interested in communism.
Yeah.
I am wondering even how you would define communism. I know. I won't do that to you, though.
From Etikoing to their abilities to Etikoing to their next.
Yes.
Which I actually really like.
I love that statement.
That formula. I mean, it's so sort of naff, but it's also it's a nice ideal for a communism, if you're going to believe in communism.
Yeah.
It's funny writing a book about psychoanalysis and communism. I mean, it's a big thing to say it's about those things, but...
Yeah.
I'm much more attached to communism than I am to psychoanalysis.
Mm, yeah.
I think psychoanalysis is really interesting in terms of what it registers historically.
And what does it register historically? She jumps in and asks.
Oh, just this sense. You know, we were talking all before about surfaces and surfaces. Just this sense that stuff's under the surface as well, which is exactly the opposite of what I was saying before.
Mm.
And that's a really influential idea, and it's such an idea that I don't think this is anything really new. I'm not the only person to have said this by any means, but that it comes out of the end of the Victorian era, and you know, being so bound up in World War I, that World War I was this thing of that it was volcanic, you know, something was waiting to happen. Any old excuse, do you know what I mean? And then everyone's just it's whole balances of power finally balanced, you know, power relationships are suddenly thrown into a whole chaotic thing, and that's very strongly associated with the psychoanalytical idea that all the surfaces we put up are actually driven by these really animal instincts that are underneath. It's a very hydraulic metaphor, you know. And I, you know, I guess it's got, why not? It's not a terrible way to look at the world. You can look at people's behavior like this still. People do all the time, right? It's a good way to think about the world. And it's probably a terrible metaphor for how history works. I mean, there wasn't actually an enormous volcano. this way, you know, causing people to shoot each other, I don't think. But it registers a need to think about why that happened as well. Even though, it, you know, the interpretation of dreams was 1901 or something. So it's way before, but it's starting to talk about all these weird dream surfaces that we have in our sleep, what's underneath them. I don't know if that was necessarily registering some kind of social anxiety throughout the Victorian era in Europe, you know, and all those kinds of... That those really balanced social forms that were just, I don't know if they were starting to teeter, if that's what Freud started to register or not, but...
I was just thinking, like, this is just Facebook dumbness, but it's interesting because people do seem very concerned about whether we're good or bad.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking with the refugee crisis at the moment, you know, like, and I... Psychoanalysis has always seemed very attractive and seductive.
Yeah.
Because it does seem to say there's an order. Well, not an order, but there's something.
Yes.
You know, and I'm wondering how Do you think that fits at all with communism, or is it that thing of putting two things together, or?
Oh, look, I don't know. I mean, I think it fits. You can put them together in a way that they fit quite neatly, which is. Yeah, you know, I guess there's a communist strain of thought. I don't really know about it, but you know, which is critical of psychoanalysis because psychoanalysis is miserable, and it and it doesn't acknowledge what a good communist would say, which is that all these balancing acts are balancing acts of capitalism, you know. And so there's a, I guess, Frankfurt School kind of readings of psychoanalysis, at a very kind of crap reading of the Frankfurt School, but would would see similar kind of volcanic pressures. And, you know, Marx wasn't immune to all this stuff either. You know, underneath the surface of capitalism, capitalism has to contain its contradictions through whatever, through ideology, through media, you know, tries to keep things down. So the working class become the unconscious. What, you know, on a very, very basic kind of association there. And so communism becomes a kind of an analytical process. You work through your problems and you build something new, and so there is a kind of a possible narrative there, if that's what you see communism doing, if you see communism as trying to make something. I'm not sure that this book quite does that, because I think communism in this book, it's a kind of an urge, but it gets very quickly complicated, you know, which I think it does.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's got their ideas, there's power involved, there's... you know, even if you think that capitalism was swept away in Eastern Europe after the end of the Second World War, which probably not quite true, but even in the absence of capitalism, if you believe in that, there's still plenty of mess and power and stuff like that.
One of the things I loved was that there seems a shift in the book from mind to body, you know, that idea of labor and capital, you know, like,
I
really, one of my most enjoyable parts was the very simple image of moving bricks and knocking mortar off bricks. Yeah. And there was something very, to move from a female character that was quite concerned with the mind and the workings of the mind, to then move to, I think she's one of my favorite characters.
The female character in H.
And I just I really love that shift to bodies, you know, and even H seems to walk, you know, and it's a really, for me, that was like just these weird kind of little electric things going off all over the place.
Well, H, with H's walks, I wanted him because he historically had this dilemma, and for us to follow, I was just kind of thinking about writing about these kind of conversations he has, and some of that's in there, but it started to feel a little bit plodding, you know. And I was thinking, well, I kind of wanted to dramatize, you know, have a bit of, I guess, physical theater, you know. I wanted it to be actually a bit of slapsticky, almost physical, not quite slapstick, but kind of have him romping about, have his dilemma be theatrical, which is kind of strange to say, given how I've talked about the book so far, but that it's, you know, it's got that theatrical element to it. I suppose nice that it has a theatrical element if Brecht is in there as a little figure, very, very unresearched Brecht. But
your Brecht is great.
Oh, cool.
I really enjoyed your Brecht.
The one thing that was influential in my writing of Brecht was reading a bit of Frederick Jameson's book on Brecht, and I didn't.
Right.
Yeah, there's just actually a quote from the section in the introduction where, I think Jameson, I can't quite remember. I think he'd talked to someone who knew Brecht and had said that Brecht had opinions about everything. It's like, it mentioned anything and Brecht like had a fully formed opinion about it. just that he was completely, a loose cannon in terms of just firing off, like it's full of energy. Yeah. And which I really liked. I was very attracted to the idea that Brecht was just actually wanting to be, like he was wanting to just design Berlin himself.
Mm.
You know, he just wanted to do it all himself.
This is something that I thought was great. I mean, and this is why I think that idea of, I don't know, what's that thing that someone said? Fiction is truth told slant. Oh, I don't know. Anyway, they just felt a lot. The thing that I'm really interested in, I know I sort of, H feels foiled artistically or creatively or philosophically or, and I, is that how you read him or?
I do, absolutely, but I don't want that necessarily to come across as a bad thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I don't want the Soviets, I mean, there's plenty in H which make the Soviets seem like they're assholes, you know, and the kind of the Soviet puppets, the Central Committee. But I also actually want to be sympathetic to them because their perspective was, you know, we want architecture to be not this alienating modernist spaceship.
Mm.
It's not like they achieved something that was organic and rose up from the body of the people, but that's kind of what they wanted. And that's not entirely stupid.
Oh, it's a magnificent, I don't know, I find it so appealing. After all the reading I did for that other book, you know, about buildings and space and the workers that make them, and it's a beautiful ideal.
Yeah.
And it really excited me, and I really appreciated the way that you did represent that.
Cool. I think, yeah.
It's really magnificent.
I mean, I actually feel a bit uncomfortable about the sort of critique of really existing socialism that's implicit in H. I mean, it's in there, and I wanted it to be in there because I don't want to stand up and be counted as someone who just believed the Soviet Union was wonderful or that East Germany was wonderful.
Yeah.
There were some problems. You know, I'll put that on record now. and I wanted it to be on record in the book as well, but it's very hard to say that without being a kind of a terrible sort of pro-social democracy. You know, I'm not opposed to democracy, obviously, but the sort of the very watered-down, righteous versions of democracy that we have inherited now. Boy. You know, it's very hard to be anti-Soviet without sounding like you just think everything's all UN and humanitarian intervention and voting every few years.
Because that's what I really... Oh, yay, the vote!
exactly.
I must admit that was something I found really refreshing in here. Like, I was just thinking, there's a book called Red Plenty. I don't know if you've read it. And that's about... It's really... it's a really interesting book. It's a beautiful book.
Yeah.
But the issue with it is that underlying it is this thing, you know, like... No matter if you are of the West, it's very hard.
Yeah.
Everything you say is kind of coded with that red terror kind of.
And
I think.
And this implicit is what we've made it. You know, we know what life's all about. You know, we in the West are so. We're sorted.
Yeah.
And that kind of we're sorted, it's in everything. It's throughout the refugee crisis. Mm. Look at them. They want to come to us. And they do for very good reasons.
Yeah.
But it's not because we're so sorted. It's because we've got lots of money.
Yeah. And this is the thing that I kept thinking about, like this, you know, because I kept, you know, one of the questions, as I was reading it, I was thinking, I have to ask Tim why they want in on culture. They seem to want in on culture. You know, the Soviets want in on culture.
Right.
And then I looked around and I thought, fucking hell, we're designing a new flag. You know, here we are. Just this interesting...
Yeah.
I'm really interested in how you know, governments kind of control through culture. Well, not control, but ideal, you know, like their ideology.
I don't know.
Like, I just found that really interesting.
I wonder, is that being successful, that whole, I mean, does anyone care? Like, what are the poll results on this?
Because this is the big problem with the flag, isn't it? That I realise that I hang out with people that think like me.
Yeah, of course.
For years when I was hairdressing, I would meet a lot of people that didn't, and when I worked in retail, and you know what it's like, when you work in hospitality, or when you're in the library, or you meet people that don't think like you. So what I think is that the flag thing's been a disaster, and everyone hates the designs. But, you know, when I talk to my father, he's into it. He's really into it. It's a great idea. Loves the black and white silver fern. It's really, I don't know, I find it really interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I know, I mean, I probably... I'm probably even more removed from it, and then I don't even talk about it at all.
I just
don't want to talk about it. Because I don't care. I don't think I'm that into flags. I just like, oh, it's a flag.
Not that into flags. It should be on your next book, too. Not that into flags. Can you... your next, this book does bizarre shit with time, which I really enjoyed. Like, I think, you know, like, you really feel the distance from Rivera. You know, you're not ever expected to feel like you're beside her walking along the path and all that sort of stuff. You're writing, is there any truth in the rumour that you're writing about time travel at the moment? Well, do you want to talk about that at all? Or?
Oh, no, I'm prepared to talk about it. I am writing about time travel. It's funny, I mean, I've got the Creative New Zealand Victoria University of Wellington writer in residence. Such a long phrase. I don't even know if it's the right way around. Maybe it's Victoria University of Wellington Creative. Yeah. So I'm the writer in residence here at Vic. Anyway. And, you know, fantastic. I get an office for a year and money for a year. And it gives me this opportunity to step back from the conditions that produce something like RHI. I mean, RHI kind of was seated partly in a similar conditions being in Berlin. But it was also written with nowhere to work, you know, all that kind of stuff. So in a way, I'm going back to Room of One's Own, which in a way, my kind of whole idea about writing has been very anti-Room of One's Own. You know, I'm very aware of the importance of Room of One's Own idea and, you know, first wave feminism, I suppose, and this idea of women writers needing this. But I also kind of think now, a writing that acknowledges the conditions of its creation is really important. This is a huge digression from your question about time travel.
I'm so digging it. I'm like, yeah, tell me more.
So I'm slightly worried that what's happening is that I'm completely backpedaling on RHI and its forms and writing a much more standard novel about time travel.
We really like your standard novels as well. We're very happy to...
Please buy them.
Just as long as you're writing. That's when it
really... so it is about time travel. It's, but I guess it's a bit of a weird novel about time travel. It's much more plotty than anything I've ever written.
Awesome.
Yeah, so how's maybe that? I am writing more... Oh, it's fun.
I love it.
It's fun. I started out with lots of formal stuff going on, and I'm actually going to... I'm not going to completely pull back on it, but I had so many different, maybe based a little bit on the experience of writing RHI, so many different voices and formal kind of devices thrown in. And I'm just actually at the moment finding myself sitting in an office of my own, just actually a bit carried away by the plot of it.
Is that something that time gives us? I was wondering this. I was wondering if... you know, like, holding everything in your head is possibly easier. Oh, this is totally a straw person, but it's possibly easier if you're going to the same place every day.
Yeah, I think so. And I think you can get... It's that whole thing about, you know, I talked before about not wanting to build a world, but actually there is a correlation to me personally, and I don't think there's any great theory to be said about this, but between being able to concentrate, you know, in that kind of separate little... world of the writing production process and the creation of a world in writing itself. Those two different worlds seem very correlated to me, and that you kind of build a little world in the kind of thinking that's available if you're set aside from the world that you live in. Having said that, I want this sort of much more genre book that I'm writing. I mean, it's not going to look a lot like a genre book in a lot of ways, I don't think, because it's The world I'm interested in building isn't... I'm really interested in having a time travel... I was talking about it for a while as science nonfiction.
Oh,
as,
awesome.
As kind of actually setting it in the real world.
Mm.
So the time travel takes place in the past, but it's not kind of steampunk, you know, it's not like, oh, let's mix kind of technology and put it into the past and stuff. It's just, I want the 70s that the book is set in to be the 70s, you know, as much as I possibly can. I don't want it to be an alternative 70s, even though it is. It's kind of like... It's again, it's the idea of interruption, I guess, that what if you took the 70s and interrupted it with time travel? So what would the 70s start to look like if you put a device into it that enables people to kind of zip forward to the current day? Well, specifically 2008 is what I'm thinking. And back again. So it's just little visits. Little nice visits to the present day. And so that's not a kind of... It's no utopian future, you know?
No.
And it's not even a coherent world because it can't be. Because if you really did that, the world would look so different. So it's... I want to have the real stuff there. I want to have the made-up stuff there. And... there'll be a logical flaw in there somewhere, which doesn't bother me.
Have you chosen a particular year in the 70s?
Yeah, well, it's a 33-year jump.
Oh, nice.
So from 1968, which is when the technology becomes... I've been a bit vague about it, but I want there to be a connection between 68 and 2001.
Yeah.
Which is 33 years, obviously. So 68, obviously, being the year of... you know, worldwide protests. And the kind of the situationist year and the Maoist year and all those kinds of things. And 2001 being September 11, obviously... And then also a connection between 1975 and 2008. So I'm talking financial crisis.
Yeah.
And I'm not quite sure why 75, except I wanted it to be 33 years. But 75, I mean, in New Zealand, it's Landmarch, it's Muldoon, it's... when did Vietnam War finally end? I mean, New Zealand pulled out a long before, but it was early 75,
yeah.
I think,
yeah.
when the Vietnam War finally... Well, not that it ever ended, but formally kind of ended, So
yeah.
There's some big dates in there, which I'm just wanting to kind of short-circuit, I suppose. Just do some historical short-circuiting. Maybe it's the stuff that goes on at the beginning of R, where her father dies and it's the start of the First World War, even though it's actually in 1909, whenever it was, you know, it's this kind of weird doubling and collapsing of time, two different times together. I'm kind of wanting to... just keep pushing that idea that two different times can kind of collapse together. But actually what it's becoming more is sort of a drugged out 70s time travel as LSD kind of, well, this is what the future looks like, which is enjoyable in itself. But
I reckon. I'm in for that as well.
And I suppose, you know, there's metaphors in there, so it becomes a kind of strange... tripping experience at the same time as it becomes a metaphor for financial services, you know, for futures, you know, that futures become this literal thing that that start to be manipulated in a weird way. Around the early 70s, you know, that's when that industry starts to go crazy, or not really crazy then, but it starts to happen, and images, you know, the way the situationists were all into the power of the image, you know, and TV becomes more available, so, and how this image culture becomes focused on futures as well, and so there's a whole lot of different very fluid ways it can be a metaphor for that stuff, but also not quite a metaphor for any of it, but it's also the ability to which is very common in fiction, I guess, that to look at the world from a different perspective, you know. Yeah. It's the alien coming to Earth and looking at the world and thinking, this is crazy. And in my case, it's the alien from the 70s coming to Earth. So that's the kind of the idea, and it's a work in progress. So
sounds amazing. And these people, are they, where are they situated? Are they
It's all New Zealand. Yeah, it's absolutely a return home to New Zealand. That's extremely exciting. Yeah, well, it's a tricky one because I want it to be all New Zealand. And it's one of these difficulties wanting to have all these global events
yes.
present in the book,
yeah,
which aren't really present in New Zealand.
Mm.
I mean, they are too, but... So I want, one of the characters travels forward in time to a data centre. Now, I'd love them to be travelling forward into, like, a major Google massive... San Francisco. You know, yeah. But I'm going to see if I can visit a Wellington data centre, because the whole idea about the time travel, you don't get to go anywhere in the world, you just get to go to your own, future. So I want all these themes about technology and stuff, but I want it to be here as well.
I just feel that excites me more.
Oh, cool.
Than Google, I think. Yeah, oh my god, that just sounds fantastic.
I know. Do you think I have to do this research, won't I? Like, there must be, like, there's data centers here.
I wonder how big they are. Well,
they definitely are.
We shall find one for you. I was just trying to think. I used to work at ACC, there used to be a huge place there.
And it still is, completely
in-house. And it was one of the, it's a very odd, they're one of my favourite places. It's like, communication is the job.
Yes.
Yet, you know, like,
they're completely illegible.
It's a very odd situation.
No, I love that kind of thing. And I think Spark has a big one.
Yeah, I'm sure Spark
I think
though.
They've got a big Wellington one that services
and
a lot of...
probably the tax department as well.
Yeah, maybe I should go to a public service one.
Public service one might be a problem. But
they probably
yeah.
think I'm a terrorist if I ask to visit the data centre. But I'll tell them I'm not.
It's a problem being a writer at the moment, isn't it? Every time you... I remember when I was jumping around building sites with my helmet on.
Yeah.
And, you know, trying to pretend that, I'm just writing a book.
Yeah.
Why do you think in RHI... that you didn't choose writers?
Oh, yeah.
I think of lots of reasons why not myself. But I'm just... It's, you know...
I think it's... this. I've confessed this before, so I can confess it again. I'm actually not a huge reader.
Yeah.
And there's something about writing about writers that makes literature into a little internal club.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm really not into that. I want writing to exist in the world, not in the world of literature. And I don't want it to be... Like, this is the reason why, you know, a completely different kind of thing. And here's me citing another writer, but I love Thomas Pynchon, because for me he was the first person I'd ever discovered who... A literary person, you know, writer, who wasn't referencing a whole lot of literature I'd never read. I was a sciencey guy when I did my undergraduate, and he referenced a whole lot of science that I knew.
Mm.
And I was like, oh my God, this guy's writing about... I mean, he references everything, actually. So, if you look for it in his work, it's all there. But it was really nice to discover that for me, that you don't have to be in the literature club to enjoy quite complex, thoughtful, fun literature. Mm. So that's not the reason why not, but it's probably the fact that I don't see myself as being, like, I'm not a book person.
Yeah.
Weirdly enough. I don't just read books, or certainly not fiction books. I mean, I do read a lot, but I feel like a traitor saying this, that I'm going to be taken off to the toilets and
beaten up with it. Bog wash from the bigger writers. Yeah. Like, Tim, you can't say that. But I think it's really, that's what I think is, this is another thing I loved about this, was the fact that it does, and that's the thing that I realised how narcissistic I am, because, I often have this idea that all books are about writing, I kind of started this project with that in mind. I was thinking, do writers read books projecting the act of, you know, the performance of writing onto that book, so that, you know, when they read about entropy, they're actually thinking, that's when I run out of ideas, or, you know, or something like that. Like, and that's what I think this, I'm just getting further and further away from that idea. And I'm further, further attracted to books that seem so, you know, to push against that idea so much. And that's what I loved in here, because it might have been easy to sort of go, oh, buildings are like stories.
Yeah.
But the book just doesn't allow you to do that.
I'm glad it doesn't, because I'm not that interested in... I think my own kind of development as a writer was... I think when I started out, I had some kind of vague ideas that I'd like to... make some kind of intervention in literature, you know, do something new, write something new, which is a crazy thing for a... And it's a very young male thing to do, you know, I'm going to be a fancy flash writer, you know, and I'm going to change writing. And I less and less see that as important. I kind of see literature and writing as a very small, not that important part of the world, which is not to say that I... diss it, because every part of the world's unimportant, you know, everything's unimportant, and it all adds up to something very important. But to kind of think, well, what do I want to influence? I want to have my writing be a voice that's no different from any other voice in the world, you know, that exists. There's no profound difference between what I write and any other thing that's said in the public sphere, or even not in the public sphere, you know, it exists just as something that's said, and that's, it doesn't relate to an ism or to a, you know, even the formal experimentation, you know, there's two ways to look at that. One of the ways is to say, well, this is, what can you do with form within a novel? And I don't really care. I kind of think that's not the spirit with which I entered it. I didn't enter it. You know, there's the sort of Oulipo kind of ideas of, and I don't really know the philosophical background behind that movement, but it seems to have become, in the way it's used, an excuse for a lot of experimentation for experimentation's sake. And I deeply love formal, I mean, I'm also uncomfortable with the idea of the word experimentation, but, you know, I feel like it's always got to be something that emerges as a way of talking to the world that's going to be heard in a particular way and not seen as a new literary form. You know, that's the idea for me of concentrating on form. But I think, you know, at the beginning, I think I was interested in concentrating on form precisely for the reason of some new... as if that was possible, some new literary form. My God.
I can completely relate. Like, you know, like I know, you know, I started out with this desire to write something completely unreadable and, you know, like would want to push the, you know, the reader further and further away. And that's something that I think is a real success in this book, is that it definitely, like... when I first heard about it, I thought, oh, that's tricky. You know, yay. You know, like a high wire act, and I'm all for that. But when I read it, there is something, you feel like this is the only way this could have been written. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I really love a book that does that, you know, that sort of says... hey, sorry, you know, like I think about Bolaño, I think about like 2666, I think about Infinite Jest. It's kind of like, sorry, this is actually the only way that this could have been done. And I kind of feel the same way about this.
Do you think it is hard? Because I actually don't really want it to be hard, even though I know it probably is as well.
It's not, I don't think, you see, this is the other thing that I think is really, I remember, I feel the same way. This is dumb. Sorry, absolute. My Wallace, whatchamacallit, fangirl is showing. But, you know, I remember Eggers saying once that, or it might have been Franzen. It was Franzen who said, you know, Infinite Jest isn't a hard book, it's just a long book.
Yeah.
And you see, this is the thing. There, I didn't even feel that there was as big a degree of surrender as I was expecting with this. I was like, oh, this is interesting.
Right.
Oh, I can plug myself into, you know, like I know this scarab of information, and now I'm being taken here. And I just found, I just think there's something incredible. I didn't find it a hard read at all. Like,
I think people won't recognize it. And if you want, which I think is a fine thing to want, if you want a form that you recognize, then you'll be probably a bit disappointed with this because it's a little unusual. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't necessarily make the moves you might expect it to make. Mm. Admittedly, there are about 10 pages of parallel columns.
I love the parallel columns.
Yeah, but they do present a bit of a... Like, how do you read options. Them? Well, this is the thing. I don't know. I read them.
I had the most amazing experience with that, which made me realise how much this book doesn't ask of me. You know what I mean? How much... Because what I wanted to... I read them because there's all those pages of them. Mm. There was a moment to settle in and sort of play around with different ways of reading. I was doing things like reading a paragraph, then the other paragraph, and then I was reading right the way across at one stage, and then I was reading a whole page, and there's those magnificent moments where they line up, you know, just like,
I'm glad you noticed that.
That was a payoff, you know, like that, whoa. And I thought that in itself, I think, is a good, I don't know what you'd call it, like a good exemplar.
Yeah.
Of all the formal play in the book is that it
doesn't... Absolutely. It is very representative in the book.
Yeah.
And it's actually the first... When people say they've read the book, it's often the first thing I'll ask them is, how did you read it? And I think people think I'm being defensive or worried or... But actually, I'm really curious because there's so many different ways. And I'm literally saying, how did you read it? What was your strategy? Did you read them one at a time? Did you read across? Did you... go back and forth, because I want to know.
Yeah.
I want to know what people's strategies are.
And this is what I thought was so great, is that, you know, and I've seen that kind of thing done over an entire book.
Yeah.
I've seen that thing done for two pages.
Yeah.
But there was something about that perfect length, because I don't know, like, this is the thing that I found so interesting about the book, and I don't know psychologically what it says about me or what, but... I just found an immense freedom. You know, I didn't feel dumb. I didn't feel made dumb by the book. I was just like, whoa, you know, like, well, I know what I think of that. You know, and I really enjoyed that. And that's where I think the parallel things are so interesting. I didn't feel like there was a wrong way to do it.
Yeah.
It just felt like, ooh, you know, this is exciting.
Here's a chance to play around.
Yeah.
That's what I kind of hope for the book as a whole, that there's that kind of, I mean, I'm not into... sheer postmodern ludism. Is that what you call it?
Oh,
you're being ludic?
What does that mean?
Ludism? No, that's not a word.
Like
ludic means playful.
Oh, playful.
I should have said playful, shouldn't I? Rather than
like
use some...
I'm going to start using that. Children, go lewd.
Yeah, that's right. Ludism sounds like some kind of pornography thing, doesn't it, actually?
Yeah,
maybe I should stop using it.
Well,
anyway,
I don't know.
Yeah, so not sort of playfulness for its own sake, but the opportunity to be able to make what you want of the book is really important to me. I don't know, I guess it's all that. Maybe it is a kind of postmodern trope about empowering readers and
Because I
stuff.
Mean, I know it's in an order, but there's nothing stopping a reader starting with H, going back to R.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? And I mean, that was something I was thinking about for my next read through. I was wondering about what would happen if you sort of mix those up even more. It'd be really good.
I wonder, that's one thing I never really thought about until it was too late, is signalling in some way that you don't have to read them one than the other.
Yeah.
Because I don't think anyone, I've stopped thinking of them as anything but R first, then H after.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any reason why anyone would have to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I always find that interesting with short story collections
is
that...
Do you always read them in order?
I do not.
No,
I
don't
either. I don't read them in
order.
I mean,
the shortest ones first.
I'm the same. I'm exactly the same. I'm like, oh, have a look.
Yeah.
And yet, when I did, because I was lucky enough to do... collection of short stories, I painstakingly ordered them.
Yeah,
you know,
it was just quite
about it. And then I realised actually what I would prefer is to put these all in a box and throw them in the air and people can take as they want.
That's kind of unbound books, say that you...
Yeah, and this is what's tricky about this form is that it seems to dictate linear reading, but it doesn't.
It's still a book.
It's still a book.
The pages are all stuck
in
there.
I love. This is what I love, is that it's still a book, but holy shit, like, it was sitting on my shelf this morning and I was looking at it and I was thinking,
yeah,
and I was just looking along my shelf and I was thinking, there's so many subversive things in here, yet they're all the same and they're all sitting on my bookshelf.
Yeah, I just love it,
it's so great. Hey, I think, I don't know, is there anything else you want to say?
No, I feel like I've not answered about 70% of your questions.
Well, if you could answer them. No, that's great. I've had a great conversation.
Yeah, me too.
And are you going to go back and write some, you're going to write?
I think so. Go and write. I think so. I'm working on another mad project, which started out with, I bumped into you when I was interviewing. Interviews with sort of random people, and doing my head in.
Good.
It's completely doing my
head
in.
In a good way.
In a good way, but absolutely in a good way, but it's having one's head done in is always slightly hard, as I'll experience in the bathrooms later when I'm being punished for not reading. I've interviewed these four people and they're from such diverse backgrounds, and I wanted to make one project out of it, and I don't know what to do.
Mm.
It's great. I keep writing more and more stuff that I don't know what it is. Like, I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if it's a book or a pamphlet or something I'm going to throw away, or a website or a poem, or, you know, it's, I mean, not that it's a poem. I could never write a poem.
You never know.
Oh, no.
Might be weird. Because that's interesting that you're playing hooky from, I'm like that too. I always have to have something else on the go that I'm kind of cheating.
Well, this is the good thing. Actually, the really good thing about a year like this is the ability to be really inefficient, you know, like this. And to have this project that I've written, I don't know how many. I mean, I've got the interviews, which I haven't even fully transcribed yet, but I'm really so unproductive about it. But I've been spending a whole lot of energy thinking about it and starting it over and over again, and just kind of trusting that something really interesting will come out of it. I hope interesting for someone else as well, but it's a nice thing about a really open year, is the ability to fool around. And I don't know, maybe the only thing that'll come out of it is a sort of a method of what to do with interview material. I don't know.
Well, it sounds incredibly interesting to me. Especially for it to be filtering through you, you know, simply because of the neuroscience background, right? You know, like, and also just, I really, the thing that excites me the most is that there isn't a strategy, you know what I mean? There isn't a cast iron proposal that's been put forward, or, I really like the idea.
It's quite strange when I went to interview people and it's just started out saying, well, actually, I don't know what I'm doing, but can I talk to you?
Yeah. Which I don't know. That
people responded really well to, actually.
I think it's interesting. I also like the way you talk about this university kind of being this odd community of disparate, I think you being here at the time is really great.
Yeah, I haven't made enough of that, partly because for interviews with the material, it's so much. And it's already driving me crazy, so I feel like I'm missing my chance to kind of go out there and reach out to the university more, but just like talking to four people like for an hour each, that's enough, thanks. That's the university vibe.
I was just thinking about this kind of resistance training that the PhD is, I just feel like I was running for years with bricks on, and then someone took the bricks off and I was arrived. I'm gonna go over here
doing creative writing.
Oh yeah,
so easy in comparison. I mean, it's not in other ways. But not having to justify every sentence is so lovely, isn't it? Yeah. It's not easy in other ways, but it's, boy, academic writing, it puts you through your paces, doesn't it?
It really does. Oh, glad that's over. Glad there's no more of that. Hey, thank you so much.
Oh, pleasure. It was a lovely conversation. Cool.